Hello everyone! Another week, another bonus episode. And we'll get to that in a moment, but first I have some very important news. This week, Andrew and I are going to be in Oregon. We are going to be at the Undiscovered C.S. Lewis Conference. And so if any of you listening are going to be there, please come and say hello. We should be having a table in the concourse area where we'll be selling some Pints with Jack merch. I think we'll have several different kinds of Pints with Jack glasses. We're going to have a couple of t-shirts. And also, the Pints with Jack cookies will be available for purchase. So if you're a patron supporter and enjoy the cookies we sent you earlier this year, you can come and buy some more. Andrew is also going to have a large cache of his rare books, which will also be available for purchase. Now, that's if you are going to be attending this conference. If you haven't yet bought a ticket, you can't, I'm afraid, because they have now sold out. But they are offering a virtual attendance ticket, which you can buy for just $20. And this will be all of the plenary sessions, and you can watch them either in real time or the recordings will be made available to you afterwards. And so this will be the welcome from Dr. Jason Lepuyarvi, as well as the keynotes. And they've got some wonderful speakers and some wonderful topics. So Dr. Stephanie Derrick, she's going to be talking about C.S. Lewis in America. Dr. Simon Horobin, he was on a HeartFinder episode fairly recently. He's going to be talking about Lewis, Tolkien, and the Oxford English School. Former guest of the show, Dr. Stephen Beebe, he's going to be talking about Lewis as expert communicator. Dr. Joseph Rickey, he's going to be doing a roundtable on new books. And another half-pinter, Dr. Jadiel Perez, and I'm particularly looking forward to this one, he's going to be giving a keynote on Lewis, the Rubbish Administrator. Another former guest of the show, Dr. Holly Ordway, and my neighbor, she's going to be giving a talk, What Did Tolkien Really Think About Narnia? And Dr. Michael Ward, who obviously needs no introduction, he is doing Planet Narnia Revisited. And then finally on Sunday, there's going to be a keynote panel discussion, which is going to be hosted by Ruth Jackson from the C.S. Lewis podcast. So if any of that sounded interesting to you, and it probably should have, you can sign up at the George Fox University website, or you can just go to the show notes for this episode, and I'll make sure that there is a link there where you can go and sign up all of those talks just for $20. Now on to today's bonus episode. This is an interview that I gave on That Hideous C.S. Lewis podcast, where I chatted with the host, Brian Shepherd, about some key Lewisian themes, particularly themes that we've looked at relatively recently on the podcast. We obviously talk about heavenly and hellish creatures, but also about how Lewis uses vision and language in his books. So with that, I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
It is a serious thing to live in a society of possible gods and goddesses, to remember that the dullest and most uninteresting person you talk to may one day be a creature which, if you saw it now, you would be strongly tempted to worship, or else a horror and a corruption such as you now meet, if at all, only in a nightmare. All day long, we are in some degree helping each other to one or other of these destinations.
Lewis and Tolkien, minds and pipes blowing, glad banter to enjoy. Cheers to the maker, the spirit, the savior, come be surprised by joy. Let the laughter welcome you in, that eagle and child did. There's room at this table, so take a seat. Duck right in, Pints with Jack. Pints with Jack.
Hello everybody, Brian here with That Hideous C.S. Lewis. Welcome back to the show. While we've been spending a lot of time in the heavens on a strange planet called Malacandra, I'd like again to take a short trip back down to Tholkandra to spend some time with a very special guest. Today, I have the honor to introduce to you David Bates. Many of you know David as one of the hosts of the most excellent and widely popular C.S. Lewis podcast called Pints with Jack. David is a software engineer who moved to the U.S. from England in his late 20s. He spent some time living in D.C., Seattle, and San Diego, and now resides in Wisconsin with his wife Marie and their two children. In 2017, David started the Pints with Jack podcast with his friends Father Andrew Lazo and Matt Bush. The amount of their content is staggering. With over 400 podcast episodes spanning seven seasons and counting, David and gang provide top-shelf material, including chapter-by-chapter discussions of Lewis's most famous works, as well as intriguing interviews with Lewis scholars and enthusiasts alike. This is a must-subscribe-to podcast for anyone, experts, newbies, or anyone even remotely interested in the works of C.S. Lewis. And if you've listened to his show, you will know that David is a master at navigating the interconnected web of themes that we see throughout Jack's works. Today, he and I are going to tackle some of those themes, and I know that you'll enjoy our conversation. David Bates, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me. And after that glowing introduction, your check is in the post.
Very good. Very good. I will look forward to receiving that tomorrow. Cash it immediately. Fantastic. Yeah. Welcome to the show. It's great to talk to you, David. And it's been cool to get to know you over planning for this and obviously listening to your podcast and corresponding with you throughout that as well. So I know one of the staples of your podcast is that you guys usually start with a drink of the day. So to make you more comfortable, make you feel more at home as you sit behind the microphone here, what are you drinking?
Well, as always, I'm drinking a big mug of the world's strongest cup of tea. Yorkshire Gold is my preference. If they would ever like to sponsor the podcast, I'm willing to shill for you. And also, just because it's tradition, I have a little dram of Vat 69, which is a kind of scotch which Lewis sent Walter Hooper, his secretary, out to the shops to get one time. So a few trips to England ago, I literally went with an empty suitcase and came back with four bottles.
I have looked for Vat 69 and I can only find it on certain websites to order. I can't find it obviously in any stores, yeah. But I've always wanted to give it a try. Well, good for you for having a dram during the time we're recording this podcast.
Yes, which is definitely in the evening, despite what everyone else might think.
That is right. That is right. No one will know. We are definitely in the evening here. Well, I guess my drink might be a little bit contradictory. Let's just say I've had a long day, so I'm drinking a cup of coffee with a little bit of almond milk to cut the bitterness. But if I were to engage in something a little more fun, this time of year in Texas, it's very hot. So I love a really good bitter, like an Old Speckled Hen or Boddington's Pub Ale, two of my favorite good beers.
Excellent choices. Yes, excellent choices. They're also two of Andrew's favorites.
Yes, I think I learned about Old Speckled Hen from Andrew on the show, and I found it. It's hard to find out here. The only place I found it is a place called Central Market, which is sort of like it's like an eclectic, you know, not quite Whole Foods style, but those types of places. And they have some really good import beers as well. That's the only place I can find Boddington's as well. So, well, cheers. Welcome to the show, David.
Cheers.
I might have to go in and get my Talisker in a minute. I'm jealous. It is evening after all. David, as I said, I've kind of gotten to know you through talking to you through prep for this and obviously through your podcast. So for my audience listeners and even guys in my reading group, would you mind telling us a little bit about yourself and in particular, how your fascination and involvement with C.S. Lewis really started?
Sure thing. So I'm a software engineer for a company here in the States. I'm originally from England. That's why I sound this way.
That's not a Wisconsin accent?
No, it's not a Wisconsin accent, but this is how words are meant to sound. I've checked with the king. He agrees.
Okay.
So I moved to the United States nearly 2 decades ago now. That's terrifying. But all of my family is back in England, except the family that I have made here in the States. So that's my wife and my two children. But my interest in C.S. Lewis began as far back as I can remember. When I was the tiniest of child, I would have Narnia read to me. I had an elder sister, so she had Narnia read to her. And being the annoying little brother, I would always come in and sit and listen to that as well. And then when I got a little bit older, my parents and my sister found that if they needed to keep me in the bath for more than 5 seconds, because as we know, little boys dissolve in soap and water, they would...
Or they just throw it all over the bathroom floor.
They do that as well. Or drink it.
Or drink
it. It's like, it's time for a bath, or as I like to call it, open bar. But no, I would actually stay in the bath if I was having Narnia read to me. So I was exposed to Narnia very early on, became a huge fan. I had a plastic push-along toy called Aslan, needless to say. Yes. My wife took me to... my mother. Paging Dr. Freud. My mother, she took me to see several Narnia plays actually in Oxford. And I am so old that I actually got to see the BBC adaptations of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, Prince Caspian, and The Voyage of the Dawn Treader all come out live on terrestrial TV. So I absolutely love those. And I actually had watch parties with all of my friends. I loved Narnia that much.
So you were doing watch parties before watch parties were cool.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I even built out of an old tent structure a box office that I gave people tickets as they walked through the door. I was a very nerdy child.
Well, that's a good tie into something else I want to talk about to you later, David, is your acting career. So maybe we'll get to that as well.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay. But yeah, so I was really into Narnia as a kid. Loved the books. And then... school became very, very busy. And I basically didn't touch fun books for a good while. And I actually didn't even return to Narnia until I was in my 20s. And I was babysitting for a family from church. The parents were running a course for parents. And while they were telling other parents how to look after their children, I was looking after their children, which was kind of hilarious because I was a single guy in my 20s. I had no younger siblings. I had no idea what I was doing. So, you know, you walk into a house and there's four screaming children. It's like, what do you do? Well, I just did, you know, what my own parents did is like bribery. That's how we're going to do this. I bribed them with The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And they would get a chapter each time I visited because it was over the course of once a week for a couple of months that I was visiting. So we got to read through the entire thing. And as I was reading through it and reading it aloud to the children, I fell in love with Narnia again. I was like, oh my goodness, I'd forgotten all about this. And I forgot how much I loved it. So once that period of babysitting ended, I bought the complete set of Narnia again and just inhaled it over the course of 1 or 2 weeks. And just fell in love with C.S. Lewis all over again. Mm-hmm. And I was also now at a point in my life where my faith was really alive. And I was surrounded by people that knew things. And so they saw me with a copy of the Chronicles of Narnia everywhere I went. And they said, well, you do know he wrote other stuff as well. And so that's how I was introduced to Mere Christianity, The Problem of Pain, The Screwtape Letters, and The Great Divorce. And so that's when I started digging into Lewis's wider corpus. And I was really impressed. I was really impressed. These books were engaging, different. They always came at things from an angle that I wasn't quite expecting. And that made them all incredibly entertaining. But I also felt that these works were much deeper than I was really fully consuming. I thought I knew there was more gold there than I was really seeing, both because I needed to spend more time with them, but I also wanted to talk about them with other people. And so fast forward a few years, I'd moved to the United States and I was living in San Diego and I was at a party and needless to say, I was talking about C.S. Lewis. And that's when I met Matt Bush, who is now one of my co-hosts. And we discovered a shared love of Lewis. For your listeners who have read The Four Loves, it's a what you two, I thought I was the only one moment.
That's right. The start of friendship, common interest. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great quote from The Four Loves.
Yeah. So we discovered that we both loved C.S. Lewis. Matt had also just started getting into the Church Fathers, who I also loved. And so we became friends and we decided, all right, let's get together and work through a Lewis book together. And I, just because this was what I did with everything, you know, posted on Facebook. It's like, hey, we're going to be at this coffee shop, you know, having a latte and talking through Mere Christianity. And people just started showing up. And so we had a very well-populated book club there for the rest of my time in San Diego. I left basically when COVID happened. But we had a very well-populated book club. And we worked through 6 or 7 Lewis books. But as we were doing it, I wanted to slow down even more. We're getting through Mere Christianity in 4 sessions. It's like, oh my God, we're rushing through too many things.
Yes.
And we'd also had people reaching out to us who weren't in San Diego, who had seen my Facebook post saying, can you Skype us in? Is that possible? And that seemed like a horrible logistical nightmare to embrace. So I said, no.
Skype, I'm remembering that's a pretty old software solution at this point, right?
Exactly. You know, but back in the day, this is a good while pre-COVID. This is what everybody used when they video.
That's right. It was the thing.
But so lots of people had asked if they could be involved somehow. And so between that and having to rush through Lewis's works quicker than I was happy to, I suggested to Matt, why don't we just do a podcast on Mere Christianity? So we can do it a chapter at a time, get out everything that we want to say. And we weren't really thinking much beyond that. We weren't thinking that, oh, we'll keep doing this for years and just go through all of Lewis's corpus. So we started it and we had fun and, yeah, that strange thing when random people on the internet that we don't know had actually listened to it, enjoyed it, and sent us a message. We decided, well, maybe we'll do one more season. Both Matt and I, our favorite Lewis book was The Great Divorce. So like, let's do The Great Divorce. That should be fun. And yeah, we may wrap it up then, but that didn't happen. And so we went through The Great Divorce, then Till We Have Faces, then The Screwtape Letters, The Four Loves. Then we did Out of the Silent Planet. And then this past season, we've been doing several collections of Lewis's letters. So letters to an American lady, letters to children, and his Latin letters to St. Calabria.
That's such a great story. And I think when we were talking a few weeks ago about this, I think you used a term of when starting the podcast, it was a reading group that kind of went off the rails, and therefore a podcast had to happen because of it. So yeah, I love how it started as a reading group. And I think in my experience as well, there is such an interest in Lewis. And I found even in my own reading group, David, when I just sent a text out to a bunch of guys, friends of mine, who, you know, we've talked about books and stuff like that, but we go camping together, we go shooting, we like cigars and bourbon. So I'm expecting to get laughed out of the room here. Do you guys want to read The Great Divorce? You know, but everybody joined and stuck around for more. And we've been at it for almost a year and a half now. But and something you said earlier, which I think is so true, when you read Lewis, it's one thing to read Lewis. There's so much rich gold, as you say there, or maybe sun's blood, since I've got Out of the Silent Planet on my mind. But you said something about how you wanted to talk about Lewis. And I think that's so key. I think that's true for a lot of people. It's not enough to just read him. You want to talk about it. You want to hear other people's perspective. What is their experience? What am I missing? What are you seeing? So I think your show definitely taps into that. And I would say as a listener, I've certainly learned a lot about Lewis, and probably more importantly, how to read Lewis. I know that's something that Andrew talks about a lot. And in fact, in my reading group, you guys were super instrumental in when we did The Great Divorce. That was our first outing with Lewis, if you can imagine that. So we started with just start with the best, in my opinion. But anyway, you might agree with that. And so it's gotten to the point where people talk about your podcast. It's no longer Pints with Jack. They say, oh, I was listening to the podcast guys the other day. So it's the podcast. So it's been elevated to a certain degree. Yeah, but it's been very helpful to us. And you mentioned a lot of the books and works that you've covered with Lewis, but not all of your episodes are necessarily about things that Jack wrote. Can you tell us about some of the other topics that you get into on your show?
Well, we typically go through his works chapter by chapter, one per season, and we have picked at the Chronicles of Narnia, a couple of episodes each season to cover that. Other people are going into those in more detail on better podcasts. But in addition to those sorts of discussion episodes among the co-hosts, we've been interviewing scholars and amateurs. And amateur is not a term of derision. It means one who loves. I would regard myself absolutely as an amateur, and I'm proud of it. But we talk to anyone who's doing interesting things with Lewis, sometimes writing books, other times creating websites, other times hosting their own book clubs. And we've tried to sort of take a holistic view of Lewis. I mean, you spoke there about the importance of discussing his books together. We've really tried to model Pints with Jack on The Inklings. We're in the Eagle and Child. That was actually the original name of the podcast. Eagle and Child. We're sharing a pint. We're talking stuff over and teasing things out. This is what The Inklings did. Iron sharpens iron, all of that good stuff. And so we're trying to mimic that. And so, you know, among the three co-hosts, we know some stuff, but there are other people out there who know even more. So we invite them in. And another Four Loves reference is about when you invite more people into a friendship, it gets even better because each person brings out something different. And so we've had guests focusing on other members of the Inklings, like Charles Williams, J.R.R. Tolkien, as well as influences. So all of the Inklings were influenced by G.K. Chesterton, George MacDonald. And so we've had dedicated months on those figures. And last season, we started something called Jack's Bookshelf, where we're literally just trying to go through his bookshelf, the works and authors that really influenced him, who weren't necessarily his friends, because they very often were, but people like Boethius, St. Augustine, Plato, Aristotle, all of these writers and figures who shaped Western thought, classical thought, and who helped shape Lewis's mind. We found that not only are people interested in what Lewis read, but knowing what he read helps illuminate his own works. So if you're reading Out of the Silent Planet at the moment, it's helpful to know a little bit about Plato and particularly the allegory of the cave, because it's going to come up quite a few times over the course of the book.
Yes. When he visits Agres cave on the way up to the Herandra and the shadows of the Sorn on the cave.
That's the first thing he sees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Absolutely. And I think you're right. And just even outside of Lewis, I find that if I go to someone's house, or even when I was a kid and I go to my uncle's house, I would always look at their bookshelves. For some reason, I was just drawn to it. And to be fair, though, I did not become a really good reader, or I should say an avid reader until my mid-30s. My high school literature teacher tried mightily. She did plant some seeds though. But I think you're right. When you look at someone's bookshelf, it tells you a lot about them. And it's very true with Jack. You named off a couple of his influences there, and there's many more. And you're right. It helps shape and understand our understanding of him and what he's trying to say. And he's very good about referencing these influences throughout his works and even in his letters. And it just gives us a better picture of him. And so I would say also as a sort of offshoot of that, reading Lewis's works is exciting. And then reading about him and who he was as a man and how he was shaped really brings it all to life, I think. And you guys definitely do a good job of that. And speaking of MacDonald, it is George MacDonald month on your show, is it not?
It is. We're actually just wrapping it up. So we've spoken to a number of different scholars. We've looked at his life, how he lived, mm-hmm. looked at his theology. We've looked at his fairy tales, how music and the arts were important to him. And yesterday we posted the episode with Dr. Kirsten Jeffrey Johnson, where we're going through the preface of the George MacDonald anthology, which was assembled by C.S. Lewis.
And that's right.
And the episode that releases tomorrow, we'll be discussing some of our favorite passages. And as we did that, as we went through this anthology, it was like one quotation for basically every day of the year. We kept hearing echoes of Lewis. It's like, oh, well, that's kind of like this passage over here in Lewis. And it's almost a game that you can play at this point when you're reading any of Lewis's influences, drawing connections between what those people thought, even sometimes just turns of phrase and things mm-hmm. that crop up in Lewis. Because you see, he was really formed by the books he read. I remember when I was graduating university, I still thought of books as basically trophies. So I hung on to all of my horrible textbooks, doing some of the most pointless, boring courses ever, because I wanted to prove that I read this boring book. And now I just get rid of them. And unless I'm going to be reading it again, it can just go. But the point of mm-hmm. books is to develop ourselves. In An Experiment in Criticism, Lewis says, "My own eyes are not enough for me. I must see through the eyes of others." That's one of the reasons why we read, to look through the eyes of others and see other worlds. When you read Lewis and you start seeing all of these influences all over the place, you see how deeply he imbibed the works that he read.
Absolutely. Well said, David. Very excited about what's upcoming with the podcast. Last question. Now, I heard a rumor. You don't have to confirm, but I did hear a rumor that there might be a season 8 in which you guys travel to a planet called Perelandra. Not sure if that's true or not, but I heard the rumor.
It is absolutely true. We'll be starting season 8 in October. We're going to have a little bit of a break because my co-host Matt is getting married, and so he wants some time off for the wedding and the honeymoon. I call him a quitter for that, but nevertheless, my wife tells me I have to be nice. So we're going to take a couple of months off while he's getting married, and then we'll return in October and prepare our glass coffins and head to yet another heavenly planet.
That's right. And beware of the unman, because I hear he lurks there as well. That's fantastic. Can't wait for that. All right. So before we get into the meat of our conversation, I do want to spend just a few moments at the beginning of the show today. I read a quote from The Weight of Glory, one of Lewis's most well-known, if not the most well-known sermon that he gave. Can you say just a few things about that quote and why it is impactful to you, David?
Well, I do think that this is Lewis's best sermon. If your listeners haven't dug into his sermons and essays, they're a gold mine, and this is probably the crown jewel. He preached it at the Oxford University Church of St. Mary the Virgin on the 8th of June in 1941. And it is a really good trailer for C.S. Lewis, because it's packed with Lewisian themes. You see them throughout. He digs into joy, Sehnsucht, longing. But I chose it because we're going to be talking about heavenly and hellish creatures in a little bit. And this is one of my favorite passages, for a few reasons. Lewis is this wonderful mixture of seriousness and whimsy. You know, he says it's a serious thing to live in a society of possible gods and goddesses. Now, those people that might be getting upset at that term, he doesn't mean literal gods, as in the God of the Old Testament. He's talking about elevated spiritual beings. And throughout his works, he emphasizes the fact that human beings are eternal. We're going to live forever. Our societies and everything else, they're going to fall apart. But the thing that is truly eternal, you know, is the human soul. And there's one of two ultimate destinations. And he says that we live in a society, in a world surrounded by people who are either going to become these great, glorious creatures. It doesn't matter how dull or uninteresting they are at the moment, but one day they could become something truly amazing and beautiful.
or they can take the other route and become these nightmarish creatures. Mm-hmm. So it's a wonderful vision and a wonderful reminder that we are walking around among these people day in, day out, even though we think this is just daily life. And this is somebody who's not that interesting. But Lewis reawakens and re-enchants us, reminding us of our eternal destiny, and then offers a reminder that all day long, you are helping each of these people one way or another towards one of these destinations. So Lewis doesn't say this, but I will. So be very careful on how you interact with people, because you might be making them a little bit more hellish or a little bit more heavenly.
Well said, David. I had a conversation with Jordan Duncan 2 months ago on this very essay, and we stuck with mainly with the theme of joy, desire, and longing, since that's replete throughout this sermon. And we got to that point, though, of seeing your neighbor as having the weight of glory on him or her, and the importance of treating people right and treating them as if they will become, as you say, a possible god or goddess. And we talked a little bit about the context. You mentioned the sermon was given June 8th, 1941. So of course, this was just after the heavy part of the Blitz in World War II. So you and I have the benefit of hindsight to look back and say, oh, well, the biggest part of the Blitz was over by then, so things were fine. But someone living in London or the southern part of England at that time, they didn't know that the heavy part of the Blitz was over. And I'm always fascinated by some things that Lewis says, and in particular this, at the end of the essay, he says, next to the Blessed Sacrament itself, your neighbor is the holiest thing or holiest object presented to your senses. And you figure you've got a nation that's reeling from the terror and destruction of war. Family members, friends, people have been killed. It's destroyed. There's probably a lot of despondency and hopelessness. And when he's talking about your neighbor, he obviously doesn't mean the person who lives next door to you. It's anybody you encounter. And this is just my thought here. I don't know if this is said elsewhere, but the Nazis and the German soldiers whom they were fighting would also fall into that category. So it was a very bold statement of Lewis to say that.
Mm. Yeah. And that goes back to the New Testament. As soon as you want to get out of loving your neighbor, you say, well, who is my neighbor? Can we narrow that down a little bit? And Jesus mm-hmm. doesn't. He opens it up. He presents somebody who would be a natural antagonist to his hearers. And yeah, I completely agree. Lewis actually writes wonderfully on it sounds odd to say, but he writes wonderfully on the war. When you see that he is trying his darndest to love his neighbor, including mm-hmm. the Nazis. When he writes to his friends and he asks them, when you pray for Hitler and Stalin, how do you do it? He doesn't say, do you pray for them? He naturally assumes, well, of how course you're praying it? For your enemies, because Jesus told you to. But he says, well, how do you do it? What do you pray for? How do you summon up the will to be able to pray for somebody that is causing you and your nation so much trouble?
Absolutely. Yeah. He has that assumption that you are praying for them and following the teachings of Christ. Such a brilliant communicator. And I know we're going to talk about communication a little bit later too, as one of our themes. So, well, let's start transitioning that direction here, David. But before doing so, I did want to acknowledge something. So I want to take a moment to announce your official membership in what I call the new C.S. Lewis Cerrone Club. So as I've said on the show before, the C.S. Lewis Cerrone Club is a Hall of Fame. But as much as people want it to be an inner ring, it's not an inner ring, okay? Dedicated to the men and women who devote their time and talent to basically furthering the cause of Lewis and introducing him to others. And so reminder, okay, what is a Cerrone or what are Cerrone? Cerrone are the philosophers, these creatures on the planet Malacandra from out of the silent planet. And they impart, of course, wisdom and knowledge to not only Ransom, but the other two species on the planet. So again, David, in giving you this honor, I'm not saying you look like a Sorn. You're probably not, I can't tell on the video, but you're probably not 12 feet tall. You don't have bat-like ears and you probably don't have gangly arms and legs. So it's more of an acknowledgement of your own knowledge and wisdom and imparting that to your listeners and others who follow you. So again, I think your podcast is, in my mind, gold standard, top shelf material. And you guys really do, in all seriousness, a great job of making Lewis more accessible and approachable across experts, enthusiasts, and amateurs, as you say as well. So on behalf of that hideous C.S. Lewis, welcome to the Cerrone Club.
Thank you very much. I would also just add that even the Cerrone are not good at a lot of things. They're often not very practical, and the Rossa and Fifeltrigi often laugh at them, and Lewis seems to think that that's okay.
That is right. It's okay. They have that fun banter that would exist in a friendship that you can do that, where you can kind of sharpen each other, but also make fun of each other and knock each other down a little bit. But, you know, they are always deferred to because, as it says in the text, the Saroni would know.
They usually
would. That's right. And so really quickly, though, David, the only sticking point on your candidacy on this was a short film that you acted in which you were not a Sorn. Can you tell us a little bit about that really quickly?
I think you're referring to Murphy Thelen's movie of Out of the Silent Planet.
That's correct.
I can't remember how I came across it. I saw the trailer effectively because he was still in the process of recording it. And he used his children and their friends. So if anyone's seen the movie Bugsy Malone, where little kids play gangsters and they're pretending that they're grown-ups, it has a very similar feel to it. But he was making Out of the Silent Planet with his children, which I thought was wonderful because it is a Lewis work that I think could be adapted very, very well to two movies. And I saw it and I thought it was wonderful. So I had him on the show just to talk through what he was doing and why he was doing it. And then as a result of that friendship, I got invited to voice a Frosser. And so I gave an Oscar-worthy death scene, I think. my other two co-hosts, they also later came on and presented their voice acting as well.
Yeah, it was great. Thoroughly enjoyed it. I loved kind of the purple color theme throughout the filming. I'm not sure how that's done. So I got to wonder, though, since you do a pretty good death scene, are you aspiring to be like Sean Bean in your acting career? Because that's his thing, obviously. Every movie, except for National Treasure. I don't think he dies in National Treasure, but pretty much every other one.
Yeah, pretty much every other one. Yeah, I don't think I can quite pull off the Sean Bean level of death scene. And to be fair, he's well practiced. This was my one and only foray into acting. But you never know.
You never know.
We'll see who else invites me on to die in their movies.
Well, keep us posted if you do, because those are always really fun. And I might have to put a link to that in the show notes as well here. All right. Well, David, the main reason why I've asked you to come on today is because, as I said in our intro, you're a master at connecting all of the intricacies and themes that we see throughout Lewis. And there's a number of them. There's hundreds, thousands probably that we can talk about. In fact, I've often thought about developing like a giant wheel, a Lewis theme wheel where I have guests on and I just spin it and wherever it lands, of course, it would be pre-planned and we just talk through whatever it lands on. But I have yet to build that, finding the time. So for our conversation today, listeners, David and I have mapped out three themes that we're going to spend a little bit of time on. We'll talk about each theme, what it means, where it comes from, and kind of where else we see it throughout Lewis. So, David, one thing I would note is that we did not choose Sehnsucht, joy, desire, and longing. And that's okay. That's obviously a key theme. There's so much been written about it and so much said about it. It is a beautiful theme, but we are actually not going to talk about that today, right?
No. And I will say, Lewis's themes, he's got many, and things that appear everywhere. Lewis's books talk to each other in that regard. If some idea doesn't immediately make sense to you in one of his books, keep reading Lewis. You'll probably eventually find the other book where he focuses on that idea and unpacks it some more, and then you'll come back and reread that earlier book, and it'll make an awful lot more sense to you. And that is what the other thing I would say, that If you want to see the themes, read slowly. Read slowly and read in community. Those are the things that we keep talking about in Pints with Jack, because that's when you notice all of this stuff. It's very easy to read Out of the Silent Planet and go, oh, well, that was fun. But there are very deep themes that you will find everywhere in Lewis's corpus.
That's right. And I would say there are two types of people in the end, those who read Lewis quickly and those who read Lewis carefully. I can't remember if I got that from Andrew Lazar or someone, but I don't think that's my idea. But I heard it somewhere and I like it. So. All right. Well, David, let's kick it off with our first one here. And we mentioned it a few moments ago, and that is heavenly and hellish creatures. So tell us first, where is the place where we see this theme fully kind of specified like that? And then a little bit about what it means.
Well, we spoke a little bit about the weight of glory, and it's definitely present there. But the place where I first encountered it and where I think it's explained most clearly is actually in Mere Christianity. This is what Lewis writes. People often think of Christian morality as a kind of bargain in which God says, if you keep lots of rules, I'll reward you. And if you don't, I'll do the other thing. I do not think that is the best way of looking at it. I would much rather say that every time you make a choice, you are turning the central part of you, the part that chooses, into something a little different from what it was before. And taking your life as a whole, with all your innumerable choices, all your life long, you are slowly turning this central thing either into a heavenly creature or into a hellish creature. either into a creature that is in harmony with God, with other creatures, and with itself, or else into one that is in a state of war and hatred with God, with its fellow creatures, and with itself. To be the one kind of creature is heaven, that is, it is joy, peace, knowledge, and power. To be the other means madness, horror, idiocy, rage, impotence, and eternal loneliness. Each of us at each moment is progressing to the one state or the other. So you can hear very similar language that we found in the opening quotation from The Weight of Glory. And this theme, you could also maybe couch it in just as simply as habits. The mm-hmm. idea that if you do something many times, it becomes a habit. This is just straight out of Aristotle. And your habits form your character, and your character informs your destiny. And you find this idea throughout Lewis. And it's not simply just by what I do. It's often being open to transformation by the divine. Also in Mere Christianity, he talks about that we have to end up participating in God. He describes it as a kind of good infection. And he says, if you want to get warm, you must stand near the fire. If you want to get wet, you must get into the water. He says, if you want joy, peace, power, eternal life, you must get into it, close to or even into the thing that has them. And he says that all these things, they're not prizes that God hands out for good boys and girls. It's right. getting to the very fountain of all of these things. And he says, once a man is united to God, how can he not live forever? Once a man is separated from God, what can he do but wither and die? So I wouldn't restrict this heavenly and hellish creatures to simply a self-improvement program, but an openness to be changed and formed by God. But it's all part of that, the paradox that he also talks about in Mere Christianity, when he quotes Philippians, where he talks about work out your salvation with fear and trembling, which kind of means like, sounds like we're the ones doing it. But then he says, for God is at work in you. So it's God's work as well. And in Lewis, we see lots of images of these heavenly and hellish creatures. So the classic Narnian example is Eustace Clarence Scrub. In The Dawn Treader, we see this nasty little boy. And what happens? Lewis tells us that he turned into a dragon while he was asleep. Sleeping on a dragon's hoard with greedy, dragonish thoughts in his heart, he had become a dragon himself. So he had been turning that central part of himself into something nastier and nastier mm-hmm. and nastier. And then it eventually manifests. He gets to see what he has become. But we also, with Eustace, not only have that transformation, we have his undragoning. We have his turning more towards a heavenly creature when he encounters Aslan. And it begins with Aslan telling him, because he'd been trying to scratch off his dragon skin. And Aslan says, you must let me undress you. And there's a very telling line in the text. He says that he didn't want to, but he was so desperate. He just said he'll lay flat down on his back. So he exposed his belly. He opened himself to the divine physician. And that's when Aslan starts doing the cleaning and scraping off these scales that had grown on him.
I love that scene for all the reasons you just mentioned. It's one of my favorite scenes in all of Narnia. And it really speaks to something you said a moment ago about how we, to some degree, need to allow God to form us. As you say in Philippians, God is at work in us. And it's at that point, as you say, when Aslan needs to finish the job that Eustace was trying to do, but couldn't completely do. There's probably a clear line, I think, to at least as a Catholic and you as a Catholic as well. It strikes me a lot as the sacrament of confession, where we go to God and we're trying to throw off these things, these sins that we've committed, and we need his mercy and forgiveness and for him to ultimately wipe it away so we can start new again and emerge as the person we were created to be. Yeah, such a great scene. And it's funny with Voyage of the Dawn Treader, for a while, I hate to say this, and I might get in trouble for this, but it was always my least favorite of the Narnia books. Oh, I know.
You're the first person I've ever heard say that. It's usually ranked among one of the favorites.
But I've come around lately. It's Silverchair or Last Battle, and it's always recency bias. Oh, I read Silverchair. That's my favorite. Oh, Last Battle. No, that's my favorite. But as I've thought more about Voyage of the Dawn Treader, and especially this scene, and also there's these new theories out, which I think you posted on your site about the Seven Lords and the Seven Deadly Sins. Like, it's becoming much more richer to me. But anyway, that's a sidebar. So we have Eustace as a perfect example of a heavenly and hellish creature. Who is another example, perhaps, in some of Lewis's fiction of this idea of heavenly and hellish creatures?
I would just submit The Great Divorce. All of the characters there, you have these vignettes, these portraits of people who have submitted themselves to one course or the other, either towards heaven or towards hell. You see people who have been hot, they've tried to enter heaven, but while holding on to their hellish souvenirs, and you see it come out in the character. Those that try and justify themselves, those mm-hmm. who are cynical about everything, those who only care about what people think of them, those who care so much about their intellect and they're asking questions but never actually getting any answers. But you also do, it's rarer in The Great Divorce, but you do see a couple of characters, in addition to the bright spirits who visit these poor souls,
mm-hmm.
But you do see some people who submit themselves towards heaven. One of them is this great lady. And when Catholics read The Great Divorce, most people will get a good chuckle because you see this great lady who is surrounded by angels and animals and children and everyone singing her praises. And of course, Catholics immediately go to Revelation 12 and the That's great right. lady in heaven and the mother of the Messiah. But funnily enough, Lewis says, no, Sarah Smith, somebody you've never heard of. But I always think, if that is how Sarah Smith is in heaven, what would the Theotokos, the God yes. bearer, be like, who is greeted by an angel as being full of grace? But we see her. We see the way that she submitted herself to heaven, but in a very quiet way. Like I said, this is someone that we've never even heard of. But in her own state in life, in her own little corner of London, she loved and she loved well. And in heaven, we get to see the full flowering of that. And also in The Great Divorce, we see one character who is in the point of transition. He has this little red mm-hmm. lizard on his shoulder that's representative of his lust. And an angel keeps asking him, let me kill it. And he keeps making excuse after excuse, all the sorts of things that we always say whenever we want to hang on to a sin. It's like, oh, let's transition gently. Can't shock it too much. Maybe tomorrow. He eventually submits his sin to the angel, and the angel crushes it and breaks his neck. And then both the man himself and the lizard transform into these beautiful creatures, the man into this great god, lowercase g, and the lizard transforms into this massive stallion that the man then jumps on and uses to race into heaven, showing that when we bring the broken parts of ourselves, even our sin, to God and put things into his hands, that he can not only transform them, but they can be the very means by which we enter heaven.
Those are such beautiful scenes in that book and great examples of the kind of the heavenly creatures. And when you were describing Sarah Smith in her very other focus, her very simple way of living and how she loved, to me, she almost becomes Marian in that regard
mm-hmm.
in how she acts. So yeah, brilliant way, because most people, you're right, were probably thinking, oh, it's the Blessed Virgin, but that would have been too easy. And so we get this other person, but you're right to think of how that would look if it was the Blessed Virgin appearing in that scene. Lewis probably, he probably is like, I couldn't write how beautiful that would be, perhaps, you know, and others. Maybe
also,
not.
also, he doesn't want Catholics to start praying.
That's right. That's right. Loudly. Exactly. Okay. Well, that's our first theme. Let's move on to theme two here. And this is a really fun one. This is one that's I'm particularly fond of myself, and that is seeing in vision. All right. Mm-hmm. So again, give us a sense of what this theme means in Lewis and maybe a couple examples of where, well, we see seeing in vision.
Once again, this is everywhere. Let's mm-hmm. start in Narnia, though, with the okay. character whose name means as of light, looks Lucy. And yes, my daughter is also called Lucy. Maybe for this reason, who knows?
Who knows?
I needed to keep plausible deniability. There's a Blessed Lucy of Narnia. There's a Saint Lucy in the early church, patron saint of everything to do with eyes, and also a Pevensey character. So if you ask my parents-in-law, I'll say it's one of them. But
Sounds good. I won't tell anybody.
Yeah, no, don't. But yeah, Lucy, I think easily Lewis's favorite character. She appears the most, she speaks the most, and she is the one who always sees clearly. You know, in Prince Caspian, her other brothers and sisters, they're blind. She sees Aslan clearly and follows him. And throughout the Chronicles, she is also the one who sees people clearly, even the spiritually ugly people. She sees the goodness that's in them. And my co-host Andrew, he loves to point out that it's because Lucy loves. And you mentioned the George MacDonald month. One of the themes that keeps coming up from MacDonald is that to see clearly, one must love. And Andrew likes pointing out the gift that Lucy received from Father Christmas. It was a cordial, etymologically, cordia, heart. So Lucy has heart, and as a result, she can always see things clearly. And throughout the Chronicles, you often meet characters who don't see clearly. You mentioned that The Last Battle is sometimes your favorite book. The classic example from that book would be the dwarves. They've turned in on themselves. They've become so cynical, they actually now can't see when they're in a beautiful land with beautiful food. They just think they're in a stuffy old stable and they're just eating rotten turnips.
And, well, the dwarves are for the dwarves, David, remember.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the dwarves are for the dwarves. Definitely one of Lewis's top themes. You see it in Till We Have Faces. I won't spoil it if people haven't read it.
That's okay. I mean, I think I know the scene you're referring to, but no, go ahead. Let's talk about that one.
Well, just that Orwell is a character who has difficulty seeing things clearly. She actually doesn't even see herself clearly. And throughout that book, you have repeated references to mirrors and visions and seeing. And Orwell, she keeps seeing things incorrectly. And it's only when she's in a state of humility that she actually does get some of the brief glimpses of truth. But perhaps safe for ground is actually to return to Narnia and the magician's nephew, because you've got Uncle Andrew. The narrator tells us when Uncle Andrew is at the creation of Narnia, he says, what you see and hear depends a good deal on where you are standing. It also depends on what sort of person you are. And this sort of brings us right back to Lucy. It's because of the kind of person that Lucy is that she can see things clearly. Uncle Andrew, he is a terrible person. He is a mean, grasping, selfish. He doesn't think the rules apply to him, and it's all about what he wants. And as a result, he doesn't see things clearly. He doesn't understand what's going on most of the time in that story.
That's right. Despite how much he thinks he knows, he misses the forest for the trees completely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But since you've been going through Out of the Silent Planet, maybe this is the place to land. And I would invite listeners to consider, as you're reading that book, how many times Lewis speaks from Ransom's perspective, his point of view, and the number of times Ransom is looking at something and doesn't even know what he's looking at. So when he actually lands on Malacandra, Lewis writes, he gazed about him, and the very intensity of desire to take in the new world at a glance defeated itself. So he was trying to take it all in, and as a result, he saw nothing. He saw nothing but colors that refused to form themselves into things. Moreover, he knew nothing yet well enough to see it. And this is a wonderful Lewis line.
This is it.
You cannot see things till you know roughly what they are.
One of my favorite quotes, I actually have it written down here in my notes as well. But you're right. It takes Ransom a while to figure out space, right? Because he sees space as in how it's been presented to him. So perhaps like a looking at situation here through H.G. Wells novels, perhaps what he's learned in school and all of that. But then his perspective, as you're alluding to, is literally turned upside down when he's experiencing space. It's the womb of worlds, the planets and the constellations and the stars. I love this line. And I know you guys do too. Stars like uncut daisies on a lawn. Mm-hmm. One of the most beautiful pieces of writing there. So yeah, you're right. And even you mentioned in Till We Have Faces, where Orwell sees this thing, which maybe will remain unmentioned here. It's her body position, right, that allows her to see that. And I know you guys spent a lot of time on that. And even in Out of the Silent Planet, it's perhaps a little more subtle, but Ransom eventually sees something or someone who will be of a great help to him, because he gets down to the stream of this bubbling hot water. There's no Hanakra at this point there. And when he looks up, he sees this creature crawling out of the water. There's a couple other places, of course, as well in Lewis, but we'll leave that for readers to ponder. So yeah, excellent. Seeing and vision, so much more. I have so many more notes here that we could get into, but I want to move on to our next one. We could do a whole show just on that one for sure. Well done. Let's move to our third and final theme here today, David, and that's communication and language. So again, probably one where we see throughout, certainly in Out of the Silent Planet, for one, communication and language. Weston seems to have a little bit of a problem with such things. But tell us your thoughts on this theme of communication and language and a couple places where we find it in Lewis's works.
Just before we start that, looking down my notes, I've got lots and lots of book references. And it kind of puts me in mind of that meme of Charlie from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia when he's trying to explain something. And he's this massive connected board with lines and dots. You could do that for any of these topics and look kind of like a crazy person. But this is what you do. You either go to parties and try and talk to people about it, or you start a podcast.
I guess you could try to do both, I guess.
You can try. I have kids. I don't go to parties anymore.
That's true. It's always a party at dinner time, right?
Well, let's at least start in Narnia, because we mentioned Uncle Andrew. and go back to that scene of creation. What does Andrew receive from the communication? Nothing. Lewis writes, "The longer and more beautifully the lion sang, the harder Uncle Andrew tried to make himself believe that he could hear nothing but roaring. Now, the trouble about trying to make yourself stupider than you really are is you very often succeed. Uncle Andrew did. He soon did hear nothing but roaring in Aslan's song. Soon, he couldn't have heard anything else, even if he had wanted to." So this is connected with that idea of vision and seeing, because we're seeing a communication breakdown. And once again, it's as a result of the person that Uncle Andrew is, the person that the dwarves are, which takes us all the way back to the very first theme that we came up with of heavenly and hellish creatures. It's what's happening to that interior part of yourself. It affects everything. And so for Uncle Andrew, he can't actually even receive what is now being offered to him. And you mentioned Out of the Silent Planet. The question of language and communication is there throughout, because you have a philologist going to Mars. So the very first thing is he needs to learn the language. But you see the contrast of those from Tholkandra, the Earthmen, as to what they do in terms of learning the language. The philologist sort of throws himself in. He does immersion learning. He lives with the people. He tries to enter into their world as much as he can. Whereas Western and Divine stand aloof, and they view the language purely as a mechanical means for communicating what they want, not to understand more about the world that's around them. And it culminates in that wonderful scene at the end, as Western is waxing lyrical in high elevated English about his worldview, and Ransom translates it into base terms, and you see just quite how ridiculous and quite how horrible his ideology is.
And the inhabitants respond in a way that Western doesn't immediately perceive, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, yes. I mean, his actions result in them laughing, and he doesn't even understand it. It just goes right over his head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very true. And Divine, you mentioned Divine. I see a little bit with him in terms of his, maybe it's a stretch, but his abuse of language, because he's really good at kind of playing both sides, and he'll say things to make it seem like he's taking you in a little bit and letting you in on a little secret, speaking sotto voce and nudge, nudge, wink, wink, that kind of stuff, which I would say is this idea of abuse of language, because it makes Ransom either kind of keeps him aloof and in the dark, or makes him think one thing when in fact, obviously Divine is, well, he's mercenary, he's opportunistic. He's like, oh, Harry's no longer important to me. Ransom would be a much better for their purpose, right?
So and you see him the men with the exact same formula. You know, who they have on toast, what they have for breakfast, you know, that same pattern. It's like, oh, I'm gonna start manipulating them with my language. And you see that follow through in the third of the Ransom trilogy in That Hideous Strength, where you see it's all about manipulation of media, manipulation of language. John Withers, who has this double talk where he says a lot about nothing or says something while meaning something else.
That's right. Poor Mark can't figure out what his job is, because Wither and Frost, they can't give him a straight answer. And so Mark, of course, gets really frustrated. And then on that point, his job ultimately is to abuse language through propaganda writing. You know, let's write two articles about the riot before it happened to give our spin of how it is. And of course, yeah, That Hideous Strength, we could spend hours on that one. Just the connections. And I was talking to Lila Lawler the other day about That Hideous Strength and The Abolition of Man. And we were both talking about how in those books, Lewis is literally pulling the fire alarm bell about these things that are going to really rear themselves in ugly fashions. And I said something like, well, he's probably doing pull-ups on them because he was tugging so hard. And needless to say, not everybody listened. On one more point on the communication and language, let's go back to Narnia again and talk about the last battle. So again, last battle's interesting because I believe it's the only Narnia book where the antagonist is the first character mentioned, whereas in the other books, it's usually the protagonist. So we've got this guy named Shift. And of course, we know the story. He finds a lion skin, puts it on a puzzle, and he speaks on behalf of Aslan, of course, which is the false Aslan. So let's kind of pick it up from there. How does this idea fall into communication and language here insofar as Lewis?
Well, I mean, in a scene very reminiscent of the Book of Revelation, where you've got, you know, the Antichrist and his prophet, you have Shift trying to take puzzle to pretend to be Aslan so he can put words in Aslan's mouth. It's sort of a demonic turning over of what we find in scripture, where the Lord speaks about putting his words in people's mouths. So throughout those early chapters, Shift is manipulating those around him. He manipulates Puzzle. He pulls on all of the relevant little strings and presses all the relevant buttons to get Puzzle to do what he wants. And it doesn't really matter what he has to say to make that happen. If he just needs to elicit sympathy and just outright lie, and even using the most perverse logic possible, it's like, oh no, if Aslan wanted us to do this, he would send a thunderclap. Yeah, that's absolutely what would happen. But the funny thing about that book is you see Shift very quickly overtaken. When the Kalormen come in, and also then Ginger the Cat rises up, what happens to those who abuse language? Well, it gets abused even further. Those who try and usurp power will have their own power usurped. And you see them really trying to play with language, particularly when they're talking about Aslan. It's like, oh, Tash and Aslan are the same. Tashlan.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Just to briefly jump back to the Screwtape letters. Screwtape says that there's a philology department in hell. And they're working very hard That's on right. making sure that we attach certain meanings to words and drain certain words of their meaning and their power. Talk about real life, but don't get him to think about what that actually means. And get him to think about unselfishness rather than charity, because it's got some wonderful effects further down the line.
Again, connecting all of these things, like the intricate web that we've described, you just said something about unselfishness. And isn't that the first question Lewis asks in The Weight of Glory? Like if you ask 10 people, mm-hmm. what's the most important thing? They'd say, 9 would say unselfishness. But if you ask a Christian, they would say something else. David, you've demonstrated very clearly just the complex web of all these things. And I often think of, if you tug on a string that is a theme of Lewis, it's going to lead you to, well, I guess we could say the wardrobe. Dad jokes are perfectly acceptable, by the way, on That Hideous C.S. Lewis. It's going to lead you to a wardrobe. And instead of being attached to one sweater, it's going to be about 25 sweaters all sewn together and stitched together. And you will just become lost, but in a good way, of all these themes and how they connect. Thank you for walking through those, David. I'll post all of our references and everything in our show notes here. And then one last question. There's a couple key dates to celebrate in Lewis history. Of course, his birthday, which is November 29th. We just had his 125th birthday this past November, and it was the 60-year anniversary of his death a week prior. And of course, there's Sidecar Day, which I think is like September 28th, 29th, depending on who you ask, perhaps. I think Joel Heck says September 28th. So tell us a little bit about what you all did last year for C.S. Lewis, or for his birthday.
Yeah, this was really fun. It just occurred to me that it's kind of crazy because Tolkien has Tolkien Reading Day. I was like, Lewis was an Inkling. Why doesn't he have a Reading Day? And so I reached out to all the Lewis podcasters that I knew and said, why don't we pick a day and make that C.S. Lewis Reading Day? And we spoke about it and settled on his birthday. So we get to wish him happy birthday as we're reading his work. So that's November 29th. And yeah, no, it was really fun. We had not only podcasters, we had YouTube channels and people with blogs. Everybody contributed somehow to honoring Lewis on that day. And we had two big live streams, one for those on the East Coast, one on the West Coast, where we just inaugurated a reading day, a day when we're encouraging everyone who likes Lewis to read some of Lewis, to share some quotations. And on our website, we've got a large cache of quotation graphics that I have checked, and I can assure you they are correct, because don't believe everything you read on the internet, as C.S. Lewis himself said.
That's right.
But yeah, we celebrated Lewis's legacy and tried to popularize his works and spread awareness on the internet and in person, and that's now going to be a yearly thing. So yet next November, we will be having the second C.S. Lewis reading
Excellent.
Day. At the moment, I'm thinking we might, we've talked about maybe picking a theme for future years. And so I think we might be focusing on Lewis and his friends. So we'll have people talking about those people in his life who greatly shaped him. And we'll be having some experts on to talk about it. And we'll have another set of live streams where anyone that's in the Lewis creative space can share their thoughts, and we can all chat together. And again, just do what the Inklings did, get together and talk about things that matter to us.
That sounds great. Look forward to the second annual C.S. Lewis Reading Day. And in terms of friendships, friends of C.S. Lewis, Joel Heck comes to mind with his book, of course, who I know you know and have interviewed on your show. Probably some good people to pull from that. Well, that's exciting. And I would just say in closing here, my reading group, we got together at our friend's farm. And so we had a bonfire, obviously had a few beers, and we went around and just kind of talked. And then everyone read some quotes from C.S. Lewis. And so we got to the point where we'd say, okay, where is that quote from? And I don't know if you knew this, David, but C.S. Lewis apparently wrote a book called Pinterest, because there were so many quotes that came from this book called Pinterest. I had no idea. I'm not sure if you did either. So yeah, we had a laugh about that.
It's the hidden sequel to That Hideous Strength.
That's right. That's right. Fantastic. Well, David, again, thank you so much for coming onto the show today. I really appreciate you taking the time. I know you're a very sought after speaker and busy podcaster and father and husband. So I really appreciate the time.
You're very welcome.
Excellent. Look forward to connecting with you again in the future. All the best for season 8, and I can't wait for Paralandra. Thanks everyone for listening. I hope you've enjoyed my conversation with David Bates. Show notes will of course provide an outline of our conversation, as well as all of the links to Pints with Jack and other resources that we mention on this show. Stay tuned for more conversations with other Lewis Cerrone and those who make Lewis more accessible and approachable. See you next time.
Why should your heart not dance? Go further up and further in. Pints with Jack. Pints with Jack. Pints with Jack. Pints with Jack.